Happy Monday, everyone. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm always excited when I meet a new author, someone who is so happy to share their books with me and who really wants to talk about the creative process and how they came to writing. So on my radar tonight is John Hegenberger, who I hope I'm saying that right. Hegenberger, am I saying that right, John?
You're saying it perfect.
Okay, great. Who actually comes with a slate of books in multiple different genres, which I love. I think it's so fun when writers stretch themselves and try all these genres. So from the heart of the country, I want to welcome John Hegenberger to my show. John, thank you so much for agreeing to be my guest on Authors on the Air. I truly appreciate it.
Well, I am just delighted to be here, and I love talking with you and listening to the show. Thanks.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. The first thing I noticed when you and I were emailing back and forth, and I said, well, can you tell me what genre you're in? Because, you know, we do genre fiction and some nonfiction in this network. And I thought, well, maybe, you'd want to get hooked up with a specific host. And you said, well, I kind of write this, and then I also write this, and then I also write this. And so I thought, well, I guess I'm keeping you myself because I like all those things. I'm particularly fond of all those different genres. So I thought what we might do for fun is I'm very interested in your Stan Wade series because would you tell my listeners a little bit about who Stan Wade is and what period of time his books cover?
Oh, I'll be glad to. I'm very interested in Stan myself. He's my alter ego, or one of them, and his stories take place in Los Angeles in the year 1959. If you recall those days at all, or have seen some old television shows, maybe like 77 Sunset Strip or Peter Gunn, these were hip private eyes back in L.A. in those days, and I grew up watching that stuff, and I kind of fondly miss it. But on the other hand, I'm realistic enough to know that that was a bunch of hooey, and a typical private eye in L.A. in 1959 didn't drive around in a sports car convertible and didn't have two or three girlfriends and drink martinis and things. He was just a struggling guy, just like he probably is today. So that's what I created in Stan. He's just a struggling private eye, not as far back as the 30s and the 40s, the mean streets of Raymond Chandler or Dashiell Hammett, but from that 1959 era. He has to, I guess, in a way, compete with all those slick, savvy PIs of L.A. And like most hangdog poor guys, he does get beat up quite a bit, and he does end up owing a lot of money, and he does, in a way, kind of precede what we probably used to watch when we watched Jim Rockford in the Rockford Files.
I find interesting about Stan Wade. You take a little bit of the history of what was going on at the time, and you kind of blend that in this Stan Wade series. Now, for example, in Spadefall, you have in the story a little bit about Jack Ruby, and I thought that was really, really interesting because It has nothing to do with the story necessarily because he's looking for a lost Hammett manuscript, correct? So I love the fact that you've kind of mixed reality. You know, you've blurred the lines between nonfiction and fiction there. What gave you the idea to do that?
Well, that's exactly what I really love to do. To me, that's some of my favorite fondest fiction myself. Do you remember, like, Nicholas Meyer, who wrote The 7% Solution, where Sherlock Holmes met Sigmund Freud. Yeah,
sure.
And there was a show called The Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, and Indiana Jones ran into Lawrence of Arabia and John Ford, and people like Bob Brandisi. He's got his Rat Pack books with Frank and Dean and Sammy, blending
right.
in with his fictional characters. I really, really dote on that kind of storytelling, where it's sort of like a secret history or historical nonsense that maybe only today we find out what was really happening. We finally uncover the real truth behind the headlines of decades ago.
It's fascinating to me because the book called Starfall, which is still the same PI, it's when the nation is meeting the Mercury 7 astronaut, and he goes to work for Walt Disney. It's just so cool. I mean, you can place yourself in the history, even if you're not alive then, you at that time, you understand what the history was going on at that time. It was really cool. And then Superfall is, this one is my favorite. America's TV superhero took a bullet to the head in an apparent suicide. And then you say, but was it? I love that. And it's really, really cool. It's just...
Well, you know those moments where you get an idea or somebody tells you something and the top of your head kind of just takes off? That, when I get those ideas, that's exactly what I want to get into the story. I want to get, whoa, what a crazy idea, and I'm going to make that work. And it goes into the story. I don't want to write anything that's just sort of like anything else maybe you've ever read. I want to kind of take something, like what you said about TV superhero, that we're talking George Reeves, of course.
Right.
The theory, when I was a kid in 1959, I saw the headlines where he shot himself. And that was pretty stunning. Today, there's been a lot of discussion of that. Maybe he didn't really shoot himself. The feeling, I think, it basically is, for crying out loud, he was Superman. He was this great guy. We're in denial. Somebody else must have done
it.
Something, Well, okay, I'll go with that. But then I got this moment of my head exploding where I said, wait a minute. We're all assuming that he was shot. Maybe it wasn't him. So maybe George Reeves wasn't shot. Maybe George Reeves, and now we've got a private eye in 1959 who's been tasked with looking into that and do that investigation. Yeah, I want to read that book, That's when I get excited.
Very interesting. Before you started writing, what was your profession?
Oh, I was in marketing. Advertising, communications, marketing manager stuff.
Very interesting to me. Very interesting. You have a lot of, you like pop culture a lot. You like, you were in the Navy. You were fascinated with comic books, right? You had a huge comic book collection. You were a dealer at one point, weren't you?
A long time ago, yeah. I used to travel the country with a car full of comics. And go from convention to convention, selling 10-cent comic books for probably $2 or $3 a piece, thinking I was making a lot of money. If I had those today, I could probably sell them for a couple $100 a piece. That's the way that culture went. Yeah.
Do you have you kept any comic books in your own personal collection?
I still have a lot of that stuff. I still dote on it. In fact, we were just talking about Superfall. There's a moment in that book where a character gets a copy of Superman comic books that actually came out and was available on the date where the story takes place. And in that story, Superman gets shot, which I remember, again, as a kid reading, and I was stunned, like, wait a minute, you can't shoot Superman. And then, of course, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about George Reeves. So it was even more of an impact for me. So I had to get that business into the story as well. And what's really important, I think, is that particular issue was available on the stands to purchase exactly on the dates where the characters in the story are dealing with the things they're dealing with. So I do a lot of research to make sure that if he turns on the car radio, the songs are the right songs, and if he turns on the TV, the television episodes are the right episodes. That's just on the pop culture side. But I really want to go back and be there then with as much verisimilitude as I can. And that makes it alive for me, and I try to work that into the stories that I tell, hoping it'll make it a lot more alive and fun for the readers.
Wow, that's really cool. Now, in your bio, it said that you were a collector of films, and what's OTR?
OTR, that's old-time radio.
Oh!
That's like Jack Benny, the Lone Ranger, and the Shadow.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You have those things
more
on some type of I'm sorry?
Yes, I have those like on CDs and cassettes and even 7-inch reel to reel tapes when I first started collecting. Yeah, I'm a pop culture nut, I guess. That's part of what
gets
into that Stan Waite series. All this
Well, I would imagine that What does your wife think about your collection? You know, it would be like a culture. It'd be like a museum, I guess, of pop culture to see your collections, wouldn't it?
Sort of. There's a lot of
How
people
cool
that
is
are
that?
Like me. I mean, you know about all these conventions that people go to. I just came back from Pulp Fest, where people collect pulp magazines and. There's a lot of old-time radio conventions, and there's a lot of old TV show conventions, and there's just chock full of people that like this stuff. And in a way, that was my idea for my target audience when I started writing Stan Waite. I figured if there's a lot of stuff that I like, they'll like it.
Yes. It is. It's fascinating to me. It is I don't want to say it's a simpler time because it wasn't. But it was a less, how will I say this? You got to use your imagination for stories of that time. More than it wasn't quite as graphic in detail.
Uh-huh.
I think.
Yeah.
Is that the correct way to say it? So I think that's interesting. I myself do not own a television. I haven't had a television in 10 years, maybe longer. But I did. Love those old-time television shows, although I was not old enough in 1959 to know who, you know, Superman was or anything else. But I remember watching some of those shows. Oh, I have to tell you, my parents used to kick us out of the house and say, go play in the neighborhood, because we had a neighborhood full of kids. They didn't want us watching that. And they never let us read comic books. They would let us read all kinds of books, but not comic books. And I'm not sure why, but it was considered not legitimate reading for some reason. I guess. We went to parochial school. Yeah, we went to parochial school, so I guess that's why, you know, they didn't want us. So that's why I guess those things are fascinating to me. The graphic novel is very, very popular, isn't it?
Oh, now it's a very, very big. It's a legitimate art form and a legitimate category in any bookstore or library that you visit these days. Sure,
that's wonderful.
But it isn't just the comic books. You would see the
not.
Comics in the newspaper, wouldn't you? Dick Tracy and Little Orphan Annie and stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when Stan picks up the paper and he looks at it, he says something about. Maybe what was happening to Dick Tracy that day in the paper, and it's exactly the day strip. I have done the research to the point where what he comments on is exactly what was in the newspaper that day, not just the headline.
Now, I do remember the newspaper ones.
There you go.
I do remember the newspaper ones. I did like, especially when they colorized Dick Tracy, I like that in the newspaper. But do they still have comics in the newspaper anymore these days? I have no idea. I don't know.
Oh, sure.
Really?
In fact, Dick Tracy today is, if you're still following this stuff, I am, Dick Tracy today is meeting up with a villain in the newspaper, and I'm talking about today's newspaper, the one you can go to the store and buy right now, you know?
Uh-huh.
He's meeting up with a villain at the Reichenbach Falls, where Sherlock Holmes fought Moriarty.
Right.
And in the background of just last week, I think, was the Phantom, another newspaper character. And last year, there
wow.
was a long story where Dick Tracy teamed up with Little Orphan Annie. So even that stuff is creating its own little
That's fascinating. That's interesting.
Universe.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really
yeah.
is. I want to talk now about Eliot timeline, and we're now in 1988, and that I can relate to a little bit better than I can with 1959. Although, you know, not to say I don't enjoy that generation and the storytelling of those of that. You know, that those ages I do. I like that chronology there. But tell me about
mm-hmm.
Eliot Cross, because he's 1988, and that's a little bit more modern.
Well, and Eliot Cross, that series is more real as well. It's not
okay.
as jokey. It's taking place in a little old town called Columbus, Ohio, as opposed
right.
to the big Los Angeles stuff. And Columbus,
right.
Ohio is where I'm from.
Right.
It's more more of a case of my attempt to do a traditional private eye story. So
okay.
we're not kidding around, but like the Stan Wade series, I try to find things that are little known, hidden facts, and use those as the springboard for the stories. Like in a book called Crossfire, Eliot is drawn into dealing with a weighing equipment manufacturer who makes scales, and they're used at the Olympics. And since the story is in 1988, and this is, what, 2016, both of her Olympic years, in that novel, Eliot is finding that if he can't solve this, the 1988 Olympics could not take place possibly. So I try to tie in some historical significant things that are give the reader the feeling there's something going on behind the scenes that they couldn't get any place. They couldn't get it from the newspaper or from the facts. They have to get it from the fiction, which I'll call faction.
That's good. I like that.
Yep.
Excuse me. Cross Examinations, is that a collection of stories, of noir stories?
Yes.
Or is that,
those are the first Eliot Cross stories, right. I did those several years ago and collected them up last year and did a self-published, literally a self-published through, you know, the stuff with Amazon.
Okay.
So there's no hardback copy of that. That's only available as an e-book. But you don't need to read that before you read the other stuff. It doesn't hurt. But
doesn't hurt.
Yeah, I tried out the electronic by doing that book. And I've got two publishers for the two series that I've got going. Plus,
uh-huh.
As you alluded to at the beginning, my science fiction stuff and my first Western.
I love that. I want to talk about the science
experimenting.
I love that because, excuse me, I'm choking here. I'm not sure why. You have a really cool little trailer on your Amazon page for your science fiction, and it's a mutiny on Outstation Zori, and I really enjoyed that, and I enjoy the synopsis of this story. Will you tell listeners about the mutiny on Outstation Zori?
Sure. That's space opera. That's a sort of a Star Wars type of a book.
Yes.
We have an ensemble cast of various characters going off to deal with a problem that they're hired to take care of, or sort of blackmailed into taking care of. But we've got space stations out there in the future, and someone stole it. So this cast of characters this ragtag team has to go out and figure out who stole the space station. I don't think I've seen a story where a space station was what got stolen. So I thought that would be a great idea. But it ends up having what I call philosophical overtones, because it isn't so much that the space station was stolen as the people on it have just sort of decided that they might want to be, what do you call them, preppers or a cult or something,
sure.
You know. And be,
we don't know.
Alone. Yeah.
Sure.
So,
they want their own society. Right.
So that's what we end up with, the mutiny of Outstation Zori.
It's an interesting thing to me that you said it's very philosophical in nature, because many science fiction authors that I speak to and people who really enjoy science fiction say that many, many science fiction stories pose a philosophical question. Do you feel that that's a true thing in most science fiction?
There's the theory of science fiction that says a story that starts off with what if
right.
is sort of a philosophical question that leads us to fiction that's what we call science fiction. And, of course, there's also Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon and space opera, which really doesn't try to concern itself with any philosophical what if. It just wants to have a good
right.
living adventure. What I tried to do in this novel was combine both of those so that a reader who really wanted to examine their feelings about a particular, whether they should go along with society or break away from society, they could enjoy that book just as much as somebody that just wants to see a bunch of ray guns shooting up and blowing up spaceships.
Right, I understand that. And it is very relevant to the world today, I think. So it's interesting to me that you said that. I find that fascinating. The Last Martian Chronicles is not space opera, is it?
Well, it's a collection. And so there's all
sorts
of stuff in it. You know where the title from, I would assume. Again, back in 1959, when I was growing up, the first paperback books I think I ever bought off of a spinner rack at the drugstore were books by Ray Bradbury.
Sure.
Like the Martian Chronicles.
Right.
And in those books, those are a collection of stories that he had previously published, mostly in magazines. And
magazines,
Some are fantasy and some are science fiction, hard science fiction. They almost all had something to do with Mars as opposed to something happening on, let's say, Venus or something that happens with...
sure.
You know,
the moon
or something.
Sure. Right,
yeah,
right.
So I collected a lot of my short stories together, a variety of them, fantasy and science fiction, and gave it the title The Last Martian Chronicles because the first story I ever sold was called Last Contact. And one of the stories that I always wanted to publish and used this as an opportunity to do so was called The Last Martian. So I was able to sort of bookend this book with those two stories, The Last Contact and The Last Martian, with about six or seven stories in between.
That's fabulous. The one that fascinates me the most is Ice Slinger, but it's all one word, Ice. Let's talk about this book. It's very creepy. This book gives me the creep, but I love the synopsis of it. So if you would please just share the elevator pitch on this book.
Oh, I see. Well, Ice Slinger is my hard science fiction story. It just dawned on me in talking with you that I seem to take each book and try to do a certain kind of book. A collection of short stories or a hard murder mystery or something. But, Ice Slinger is a story that takes place on the moon Ganymede, where corporations have set up civilizations and little operations where they can scoop up the ice from that moon, sling it on a catapult out the gravity well so that it drifts through space back toward the asteroid belt or Mars, where it can be taken and then melted down to terraform the planet or help populate the asteroid belt. So with that as the mechanical science background, then we have our characters who are dealing with that every day and the problems that are involved with it, the problems with the corporations and the problems with the mechanical equipment and the problems with the physical weather environment that they're in. With all that going on, I ended up with a pretty hefty little story there that I really had a good time creating that historical, futuristic world.
John, you know, when you're talking about terraforming and all, it's so fascinating to me because I love to follow what our space probes are doing. And, you know, they talk about eventually putting people on the moon or on Mars or other planets and everything. And I think a lot of them have to do with terraforming and finding habitable or creating a habitable environment for humans should they decide to go. And so I'm that's why this book fascinates me, because this book is just, it takes a little scoop out of hardcore real science, and it seems to have a nice little mysterious villainous twist to it. So kudos for that. Do you realize when you're writing your books that you're writing them in such different ways that you know, the First Mutiny was very philosophical. Chronicles was your short story collection with a little bit of everything. Yet here you are with Icelinger, a very hard science fiction take on almost a thriller science fiction. Are you aware when you're writing it that's what you're doing?
Well, actually, like I said a minute ago, it didn't dawn on me that I was sort of trying to go in a different direction each time until we were just now talking. But at the time, whenever I'm writing any of those books, I'm, you know, got both feet in, ready to go in that direction, not really thinking about, I just did a Western, now let's do something different. No, it's just I'm inspired by whatever the particular story is, and I'm determined, you know, to try to do my best to be able to create that type of such story. So if I keep it up, I'll probably run out of genres and subgenres. But honestly, like I said, I wasn't really thinking that I was doing that until just a few minutes ago. So it doesn't bother me. I'll just keep writing whatever
That's
I think
wonderful.
I get most inspired to do.
Well, so let's talk about your inspiration then. You know, I know that a lot of authors who are really write in one genre, whether it's fiction genre, literary fiction, whatever it happens to be, many of them have just ideas floating around in their head all the time. Some of them capture them in notebooks or have little pieces of paper stuffed in a file folder somewhere. You seem like you have so many ideas that you want to experiment with on paper, and that's a wonderful thing. But how in the world do you decide which one you want to actually sit down and tackle?
Oh, well, that sort of depends on whatever happened, like the day before, the week before, the month before. It isn't like I'm trying to write three stories or four stories at once, but I do have to, like you say, decide every so often, like, okay, what next? What's the next project? And when I ask myself that, I guess I kind of look around and say, well, let's see. First of all, maybe what haven't I done? Second of all, well, what's hot in the market these days? And more importantly than any of that is probably what can I do that's better than what I've already done? You know, what's that next challenge that I don't want to write, you know, just another of the same old thing. I want to up my game a little bit and try to write something even more significant, like let's put a little more romance into this next book. I haven't done much with romance, and I can see my characters seem a little two-dimensional. So let them really just get together and be real people, man and woman, whatever the case is, and have that be part of a legitimate portion of the novel and not just treat them like comic book characters, if you will. That's just an example.
Pardon me. When you start writing, do you start with your characters or do you start with the story?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. I start with the story, the concept, then the plot, then the characters, and then percentage-wise, it's sort of like 20% is the concept, 30% is the plot, and 50% is the characters. A lot of time goes into the characters, but I don't start with the characters. I sort of build the world, the universe that they're in, all that research we talked about, and then say, okay, now, in that kind of a world, what kind of people would, what would people be like, you know, what would people be interested in or worried about? And then next thing you know, you've pretty much got a character that who actually lives and breathes in the reality you've created. And then you have to just continue to layer stuff on so that the reader can identify with that character in that situation and make the story seem vivid and real and true.
Is there anything that you're not willing to try?
Somebody asked me about noir, and I gave it a shot. And I have a tough time with noir because it's just feeling too down, too depressing, too negative, too noir. Okay. So, in fact, I think of Stan Waite as being noir-stalgia. Yeah, it's a little bit like that, and that's about as close as I can get. But just to write a story, and I, you know what, this dribbles a little bit over into horror, too. Just to write a story to have people get killed and die or bloodied up or slaughtered or disappointed or lost. I mean, this doesn't sound like a fun day of writing to me. And I understand that it's a fine genre. It's just that I have to have fun when I'm writing, or I don't think that my work's any good. So I
because
guess
you're,
stay
you
away from
say
this too.
You say Cross Examinations is rollicking noir stories from the heart of the heartland, which is interesting to me because you know, we have a show in this network, one of my sister shows, I guess, or brother shows, whatever you want to call it, Noir on the Radio, and several others, as a matter of fact, that talk about noir as a genre, noir, pulp, and dark crime fiction. And I'm fascinated by it. I've read some outrageously good noir that where you know, it's not, I mean, it's such a good story. No, you may not have the romance happily ever after thing, but, you know, they're so good. And I'm just thinking, have you ever considered writing steampunk, which is a connected genre of science fiction?
I've looked at it, actually, when it first started coming out. I thought it was cute. Since then, of course, it's blossomed enormously, and I'm not sure that I understand it right now. But if I were to have some characters who went back to 1888 in an alternate reality, I guess that would be steampunk. I just haven't decided to go play that game yet.
Well, you know, to me, I always look at, we're talking about old TV shows. So the Wild Wild West, to me, was very steampunky. And, you know, Jules Verne were steampunky, and those Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines, and especially the Wild Wild West movie was exceptionally steampunk.
Yeah, I agree.
The Distinguished Gentleman, you know, the League of Distinguished Gentlemen, that was very steampunk too. I really enjoyed all those, but you're right. You have to really be on point with those things to create them. And they can be very fun. I have read a lot of really good steampunk. I enjoy it. I wish there was more out there. I will say this though. There are a lot of terrific women steampunk writers. I don't know why, but they are some terrific women steampunk writers. So what is Triple I?
Well, Triple I is the name of the first private eye agency on Mars. So that might be steampunky for you in a way, because the main character is a hard-boiled private eye, and he wears a fedora and goes around, you know, dealing with crime in the mean streets of Mars. So again, I hadn't thought about it, but I'm sure glad we're talking about this.
It's all gears and wheels and flying machines, but also with a very Victorian overview is the way that most steampunk authors have described it to me. The clothing is very similar to steampunky, but it's also very gender neutral, which I think is really interesting too. Maybe that's why I'm so drawn to it. Now, you mentioned that you wrote a Western, but I'm here on your page, your website, and I don't see mention of a website of a Western. Tell me what it is, and let's talk about that. Because Westerns, I think, are becoming very popular again. Is that Blaze, Bloody Wyoming?
Yeah.
Is that what it is?
Bloody Wyoming.
Okay. So let's talk about this. And why a Western?
Well, I was invited to contribute to the series, the Blaze series, and I couldn't turn down the opportunity to try my hand on a Western. To me, it's sort of like taking everything we were discussing about 1959 and 1988 and let's throw it all the way back to 1877. Can I make that work there or something similar to it? So I wrote that novel, which came out last month, which is part of the reason why you might not see so much about it. I haven't got a chance to really get it marketed up like I should.
Right.
And I'm in the process of writing a second one called Ace Heart, which gave me the fun opportunity of having a character in one novel go into the dance hall, the gambling hall, sit down at the poker table, pull out his guns and take the money and run. While in the second novel, we have the very same scene, only now we're seeing it from the gambler who's sitting at the table, and this guy comes in and sits down to play poker and pulls out the gun and takes the money and runs. So I got to do a self-reflective scene from two different books.
Carried some characters from one book into the other, but you're using a different point of view, which is a very interesting writing plot.
Exactly.
How wonderful. ITW and several other writer organizations. Have they helped you?
Yeah, I think ITW has done a lot to help promote me and get me connected with a lot of people like myself who want to play in that sandbox and want to grow their careers. PWA is a wonderful organization. I got to help judge the short stories this year for the Seamus Award, which will get handed out there at Boucher. CIFWA, I've been a member of CIFWA for a long, long time because I started my writing career writing science fiction, and I recently joined Sisters in Crime. So we'll see what that leads me to. Yeah, I think there are a lot of really good organizations. And
I want to congratulate you on being, congratulations on being so willing to try your hand at different things. I wonder what genre you'll settle on, and if you will, or if you'll continue to kind of play around with all of them. It's a fascinating thought, and congratulations on being so brave to do that. I asked a lot of authors who are very well established that, and they say, oh, no, I think I'd like to do this, but maybe I wouldn't. I don't know, and, I'm well established, and it might confuse my readers, and I'm thinking, that's true. You have to think about your readers. But it would be a shame not to explore other avenues if you have the opportunity. John Hegenberger, thank you so much for being a guest on my show tonight. I so appreciate it. Tell everyone where we can find you on social media and on the web, please.
My webpage is johnhegenberger.com. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, I've got a Goodreads page, an author's page on Amazon. I forgot what else.
Oh, good.
Printers.
All right.
All over the
You're
place.
Well on your way. You're well on your way. Well, for those
Thank
listeners
you.
Who are not going to hear me tomorrow, you will indeed hear Thrill Seekers Radio with Alex Dolan and Noir on the radio. They're having a flash fiction throwdown, so go over there. I'll be back on Wednesday at 1 o'clock with Jacqueline Machard's Summer Scribe series, and her guest is, I think it's Ellen Whitlinger is her guest. And I'll be back again on Friday when Steve Conkley and Tom Abrams interview each other. John, thank you so much for being here, and I hope you come back again. Good luck with your
thank
writing.
You. Thank you. I really enjoyed being here.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you. Thank you so much. Have a great evening, and you and I will talk on the webs, okay? Talk to
okay.
you later. Okay, good night.
Bye.
And thanks so much for being with me tonight, listeners. I really appreciate it. Have a really great evening, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.